Welcome to episode 435 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview David McNamee. I'm sure most people listening are probably very familiar with David. He placed third in Kona in 2017 and 2018. He is now a T100 contracted athlete, and in today's interview we'll discuss his training and racing in depth, and also things that David has learned across his career in the sport, spanning 18 whole years. So that's a lot, as you can imagine, and I found it a really good and interesting discussion. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. I want to talk about the Flow Gel that they produce, which is a massive gel pouch containing 300 grams of carbohydrate that just flows really well. So it's made for putting it in a bottle that you can carry on the bike, especially instead of squeezing 10 gels into a bottle and mixing it up with water. So this is something that I used to do, and a lot of people used to do, squeezing those gels into a bottle. But now there is a dedicated product that is specifically designed for this purpose, which just makes it slightly better and also easier than how we used to do things. I had tried the Flow Gel in training before and was really excited by it, but now I have finally used it in racing and I can report that it worked absolutely brilliantly. I had the entire Flow Gel plus two Precision Fuel caffeine gels of 30 grams of carbs each over 2 hours and 10 minutes in a half distance race. So that adds up to 160 plus grams per hour of carbs on the bike. And then came onto the run feeling really, really good and with very high energy levels throughout the run. That was the highest carb intake that I've ever managed on the bike in a race. And the Flow Gel just made it really easy to do so. And I had no problems at all. So as a listener, you can get 15% off your first order of any products on Precision Fuel and Hydration by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And I highly recommend that you give them a go. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. For a lot of athletes, the limitation to swim training is that it can be very time-consuming to swim when you consider everything that goes into a swim workout, including commuting to the pool, all of the faff that you may have to get through at the pool before actually getting into the water. And this means that for a lot of people, it might only be realistic to swim once or twice per week. With the Senate, you can complement that pool swimming with quick and efficient home-based workout that challenge the swim-specific muscles, so you can increase that all-important frequency of training and give yourself a chance to keep improving your swimming even when your pool time is limited. Try the Senate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with David McNamee. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, David. How are you doing?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be on the show. And yeah, I'm good. As I just mentioned to you, I'm just back from a 4-hour bike ride with some hill reps on the bike to try and get ready for San Francisco, the T100 race. And now, yeah, it's great to be on the show. And later on, I'll go for a little run. So as always in a triathlon life, it's a busy, busy day.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure that most listeners will be super familiar with you and your resume, and I'll definitely put links to things like your PTO results page. So instead of asking you who you are when most people already know it, can you tell us something about us that most people will not know, have no idea about, some fun trivia or fun facts?
I'd say I'm obviously a very proud Scottish person. I'm a very proud British person too. I do believe you can be both. But actually, for the last 10 years, I've lived in Spain. And yeah, Spain is my home now. So yeah, I think that sort of is something that some people know, but a lot of people don't.
Yeah. You're in Girona. Are you in Girona right now?
Yes. So yeah, I've been in Girona living since 2015. But for training, I first came in a training camp here in 2010 with British Triathlon when Joel Filio was actually the head coach and his squad is actually based here. Now since 2020, so yeah, it's sort of nice that sort of we've been able to reconnect so many years later.
And what's something, give me one to three things that you love about Spain and or Girona in particular, and one to three things that you find that you don't like, that is better back in Scotland or UK?
I think just in general, Spanish, the road surface is a lot better than in the UK, especially in Scotland. The roads in Scotland are terrible, to be honest, to cycle on, just the sort of quality of them with the winter. So yeah, the Spanish road surfaces are perfect, and I really love just the general atmosphere in Spain. It's a very outdoorsy country. People like to go out and just go for walks in the town and stuff, and I always felt living in the UK, especially when I go back to visit, is that a lot of people spend too much time in their homes. I much prefer to go out and sort of meet someone for like a quick drink or something. And yeah, it's just a lot more sociable here, I believe. And yeah, for training, obviously, we have the sunshine in Spain, which is the biggest difference. It was one of the big driving factors for me to leave Scotland, was trying to be an Ironman athlete whilst living in Scotland was, I wouldn't say impossible during the winter, but it came with a lot of challenges that I just didn't want to keep on facing year after year. So yeah, I came for the sun and I've stayed ever since.
And is there one or two challenges or things that work easier back home or back in your previous home?
I think the big challenge was when I first moved here was English wasn't really spoken. It has sort of improved massively over the last 10 years. So the first 6 months to a year, there was a lot of difficulty trying to understand things. And obviously learning Spanish and Catalan was difficult. And yeah, I think maybe there's more bureaucracy here around doing things. But yeah, apart from that, there's not too much. You know, we drive on a different side of the road here, but after a few months, you get used to that. So yeah, in general, I don't really have any complaints about living here. Maybe, you know, I miss some of the food things that you can get back home. Some of the sort of like scones and stuff, and porridge is more accessible in Scotland. But yeah, apart from these little things, yeah, I very much see Spain as sort of my home.
Excellent. So let's dive into some triathlon discussions. First of all, can you discuss your plans for the rest of 2024? So you're a T100 contracted athlete, but what does that mean in terms of races that you're doing? And are there other goals aside from the T100 series?
Yeah, so with the T100 contract, you're actually contracted into the 6 events during the year. But I think I'll probably end up doing 7. Because I really want to give myself the best chance of doing well in the series. I think it's a fantastic series to be part of. And yeah, I hope it continues to grow over the next couple of years. So that starts with San Francisco in just over 2 weeks' time, which is similar to the Escape from Alcatraz course. And then after that, I'll be following the T100 circuit throughout the year. I think the only event that I'll miss is probably Las Vegas, because it's the week before Hawaii, and I do want to go back to Kona. I've obviously had some great memories on the island, but also the last 2 attempts have been disasters, so I want to go back and give it maybe one final shot and see how it goes. So that's it. So obviously I need to qualify for Kona, which leads me to Ironman Victoria Gasguy in July. And yeah, I think that's basically going to be the season, is T100. Ironman Victoria and Kona.
All right. Yeah, no, that sounds like a great season. And about the T100 series, I want to ask a bit about what it is like to be in those races. So obviously a big factor is that the strength of field is really high. You have just a field stacked full of world-class athletes. But does it feel very similar to racing, let's say, a 7.3 Worlds or another 7.3 with just a super strong field? Or is the distance itself slightly different than the standard 70.3 distance? Does it make it possible to race it even slightly more intensely?
I'd say physiologically it's very similar. I don't think there's only an extra 10 kilometers of biking in the 70.3 and an extra 3 kilometers running. I think physiologically it's very similar. I'd say the biggest difference is actually the drafting rules, in that in the T100 series, they went for 20 meters, whereas in Ironman, it's still the 12 meters, which makes a massive difference. It makes a big difference to how you approach your training and to the race itself, in that let's be honest, when it's a 12 meter gap, if you're in a big pack of athletes, as soon as you're sitting third or fourth or further back in that group, you're pushing 30 or 40 watts less than if you were on the front. Whereas in the T100 with the 20 meters, yes, being 20 meters behind you maybe still get some sort of an advantage, but it's a lot less. And it just means that the racing's a lot, in my opinion, a lot more fairer. And it just gives athletes that ability who are strong bikers to show it. And I think Sam Long's been the perfect example of that this year. I think if the T100 was 12 meters apart, then Sam Long wouldn't have had the podiums that he's had this year in the series. And I think that's the biggest difference between a stack 70.3 World Championship event or a T100 event. It's not the demands of the event itself. It's literally the rules that we play by.
Mm. And what has your experience been with the use of Race Ranger? People have had opinions on it, as will always happen, but what has your experience been in the races where it's been used so far?
Overall, I think it's a great system. I think it's good for the athlete to have that sort of visual cues of exactly where they are. I think it's still not being used to its full capabilities. I hope as we move forward that we can bring Race Ranger more into sort of giving out drafting penalties and deciding who's actually been drafting and not. For example, right now, after the race, they have the ability to look at and to see exactly how long each athlete spent in the drafting zone. And I hope that in the future we get to a point where, I don't know, maybe in the last 5 minutes of the bike leg, the referee can look exactly at the data there and then. And say, for example, we take T100, so we have 20 athletes, and the referee can see at that moment that 18 of those athletes have spent between 20 seconds and 1 minute in the drafting zone. But we have two other athletes that have been drafting for over 10 minutes, even though they've not been caught by a referee. Then why shouldn't the referee then at that point, well, we know they've been drafting, we trust the data that Race Rangers give us, then we will enforce a drafting penalty as soon as these athletes get into T2. So I think, yeah, my answer, it's been good, but I feel like there's a lot more to develop.
Mm. And you mentioned how the drafting distance has changed your training. Does that simply mean a slightly more focus on the bike due to how important that becomes with the longer drafting distance? Are there any other specifics to how you have changed your training, perhaps, with focusing on the T100, or is it very similar to what you have been doing in the last few years?
I think the 20 meters has definitely meant that there's a bit more of a focus in the bike, purely because the standard of biking has increased over the years. And with 20 meters, you really have to be a good cyclist now to compete. In my early years of the sport, my cycling wasn't the strongest, but I could still get good results by going to the right races where it wasn't the hardest bike course. And as I said, sitting 12 meters behind an athlete, you don't have to be the strongest athlete in the world to keep at that 12 meters. So yeah, it's meant that there's been more focus in the biking, and being more focused on the T100 as opposed to Ironman so far this year has meant that I've did more sessions focused around that sort of LT2 race power sort of work. I don't say there's not been a dramatic shift in my training. I'm an athlete that's did well just by being consistent week in, week out of what I do. But yeah, there has been some minor changes, and mainly around the biking, and sort of rather than doing a lot of work at sort of Ironman pace or LT1, just that shift towards LT2. And obviously with San Francisco coming up and there being quite a lot of hills involved in that race, I've been doing, yeah, a lot of hill reps and trying to prepare myself for as best as possible.
Yeah. And can you tell us more about your training setup, including things like coaches that you're working with, training squad, and training partners, those sorts of things. What does your training setup and environment look like?
Since the last 2 years, I've been coaching myself. But before that, I was working with David Tilbury Davis. But as I said, I'm in Girona, and I'm very fortunate that since 2020, a key group of the athletes in Joel Ferlio's training group have been based here, with Drew Box as their coach. So that's like Vincent Louis, Yella Jens, Vasco Villasa. And yeah, it's been great in that even though I'm not coached by either Joel or Drew, I used to be coached by Joel actually like 10 years ago. So we've known each other for a long time, that I'm able to join into the training when I want, which generally means that I swim with them 5 times a week. Maybe I go out on a bike with them once or twice a week, and I do 1 or 2 runs a week with them. So yeah, it's been great to sort of have those guys to train with. They're some of the best athletes in the world in ITU, and it's really motivating to have that sort of standard of athlete to sort of train with, especially now that they've decided to come and live in Girona.
Yeah, no, that's a great opportunity for sure. What is, when you choose bike rides or runs that you go and do with that group of athletes, do you choose the kind of aerobic sessions, or do you sometimes choose to go and do some of their harder stuff just to, I don't know, get a bit of a change and mixing things up a bit? How do you think about that?
So with the swimming, I do like all my swims with them. I swim 5 times a week, so I just join with them, yeah, in the pool. The biking, I mainly do like the aerobic easy rides with them, and then running a mixture of aerobic stuff, but I also do some sessions with them. Usually on a Saturday morning, I run with the group because it just is a good session. Joel, and I believe you've interviewed Joel before.
Yep.
He's very much a coach who doesn't believe in doing crazy intensity and going way above race pace, even with his ITU athletes. He sees very much it's about being training roughly around race pace or slower and just being strong. So a typical Saturday morning run session during the winter would be joining the group and doing like a 60-minute build run, where we start off at like 340 pace and descend down to 320 pace, which I think for a T100 athlete is perfect. 320 is roughly what I want to be running at in a race. So yeah, that works out perfectly for me. And yeah, every so often I try and join them on a Tuesday night for a faster session, which usually ends with me being dropped. But it's good fun. I think it's good training for me to do some fast work every so often. But a big fact of why I do it is I just enjoy doing it, which I know to some people might sound very amateur style to sort of do something purely because it motivates you and you're excited by it. But yeah, that's one of the reasons why I join them, for the faster, shorter stuff every so often.
No, that makes complete sense to me. About the bike setup that you have, how much of your riding do you do on the TT bike versus sometimes going out on a road bike? And do you ever stay inside on the turbo if the weather is bad, or do you always, you have a plethora of options for road cycling, so I guess you don't have to use the turbo much, but is that something that is ever an option or never?
I think the turbo is actually a really good training tool, especially, for example, if you're preparing for a course like Hawaii. And Hawaii is a course where you literally can pedal for 180 kilometers, even on the downhills. So you have to get used to constantly turning your legs over. And I think that's very hard to do outdoors. There's always descents where you have to stop pedaling or stop signs and stuff like that. So I think for specific races, it's very good, the trainer. And yeah, even though Girona is obviously sunny, we do also have bad weather. So yeah, I don't have anything against being on the turbo. I think it can be a very good training tool, and obviously it's very time efficient. However, I love being outdoors, and yeah, I would say, especially during race season, I do all my key sessions on the time trial bike. But with regards to aerobic riding, especially if I have a group to join, I'll always be on the road bike. And then every so often I'll go out on a gravel bike. But again, that's just when I want to do something different and to have some fun.
Yeah. All right. So now, I don't know if you have your Training Peaks open or something like that, but I'm going to ask you if you could take us through your last full week of training in detail from Monday to Sunday.
Okay. Yep. So the first thing is that I'm not like most triathletes where the Monday and the Friday are the easy stuff. Just the way my life works. My recovery days are actually Thursday and Sunday. So yeah, that's the sort of big difference to start with. But apart from that, I genuinely, 52 weeks of the year, well, not 52 weeks, 50 weeks, 49 weeks maybe, swim five times, bike five times, and run five times a week. And yeah, that breaks down to, so last week was Monday morning, I did a 5 kilometer aerobic swimming. That was just an easy sort of long swim. And then afterwards, I went out on the time trial bike. And for 3 hours, of which I started my San Francisco specific prep. So I did 10 by 4 minutes hill reps, trying to, I like to sort of base things on effort. I look at the power, obviously, but I know it's not very sort of maybe scientific, you'd say, but I always go for the main thing is how it feels and the effort of a repetition. And then I look at the power and then the heart rate. So it was 10 by 4 minutes. I ended up averaging between 370 to 300 watts. But the main goal was to sort of ride at that sort of intensity that I want to be racing at in San Francisco. So that was the bike session. And then I ran 40 minutes in the evening, just easy. So then the Tuesday, we did a 5 kilometer swim in the morning. And we did a build session in the pool. And yeah, I remember that because I think Vincent was swimming very fast and I was very far behind him. And then I rode 2 hours very easy on the bike. And then I did a run session in the evening by myself. And that was 6 by 2 kilometers with 1 minute recovery. And the 6 by 2 kilometers I ran, I started at 320 pace and finished at 315 pace. And again, that's sort of roughly where I want to be racing in San Fran.
And what was the build session in the pool? What was the specifics of that set?
So it was a session of 300 as negative split, and then 4 by 150 as build every 50, and then 4 100s descend, and then we did 100 recovery, and we did that twice through. So it's sort of like, it's not a super hard session because obviously the guys are between races and stuff, but it was just to get the body going, I think, for them. And yeah, it was good for me. And then the Wednesday morning was a 5 kilometer swim, again, just aerobic with some paddle work, 4 800s, paddles pull. And then I rode for 4 hours in the afternoon, just aerobic. And then Thursday is the easy recovery day, and I did 1 hour 10 minutes running in the hills, and yeah, a very slow average pace of 5:15 kilometer, and I went to the gym later on. Then Friday was another 5 kilometers in the pool, and again we had a little bit of speed work, but nothing crazy. Yeah. There was some 50s fast, but nothing too much. And let's see. Then another two-hour bike easy in the afternoon. And then I did a run that night. And it was 21 kilometers. But with 15 kilometers as 1 kilometer at 70.3 effort, 2 kilometers at Ironman effort. And that sort of, yeah, that's like a standard run that I'll do quite a lot, especially because the group are between races right now. They weren't doing many run sessions, obviously, as they were recovering. So I was just by myself. And then Saturday, I did a 4 hour bike ride with 4 by 20 minutes at 300 and I think 310 to 325 watts with average between the 4 by 20 minutes. And that was just trying to focus at T170.3 effort. And then in the evening, I ran 24 kilometers at 4:15 pace. So not easy, not hard, sort of solid aerobic, I like to call it. And then Sunday was the easy day, super easy, 4 kilometer swim, and then home in time for family lunch.
Excellent. And so this would have been then, so it was last week as we're recording. So is that at the end of the week, you're 4 weeks out or 3 weeks out from the T100 San Francisco here?
So 4 weeks.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
To put things into context a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so that's an excellent overview. And this is, I guess, something that is, as we discussed already, pretty typical of what you're doing.
Yeah, so I'd say, as I said, every week I generally do 5 swimming sessions, 5 bike ride sessions, 5 runs a week. It does vary. Usually I do the run session a Saturday morning rather than the Friday night. But as I said, because the group were between racing Yokohama and Cagliari this weekend, they weren't doing the run session Saturday morning, so I changed it a little bit. But yeah, that's generally, I would say, hour-wise, it's probably 27 hours a week, plus I do the gym as well twice a week. But yeah, I think quantifying things by hours is always sort of a bit stupid, because 26 hours of aerobic training is very different from 26 hours with a lot of intensity. Sort of, I find I do best by being consistent. And yeah, I think sort of I found what works for me and I stick with it.
Yeah, we'll definitely come back to that, some of the things that what you've learned over the years in terms of what works for you. But before that, when you are preparing for something like, for not something like, but for Kona specifically, what might the peak sessions that you do look like for that specific race?
So for Kona, I'd say the peak sessions usually come between 2.5 weeks to 4 weeks before the race. Generally, I fly out to Hawaii 2 weeks before the race, and I don't want to get on the flight too tired, because that always sort of increases the chance of getting sick whilst you're traveling. So I always try and have 2 or 3 days easy before I get on the plane. So I usually hit the last hard sessions 2.5 to 4 weeks out. And I have a few key sessions that I've been doing since probably 2016-17. And yeah, I suppose swimming-wise, I have two, one being in the pool doing 12 300s on 4 minute cycle and trying to swim like 112, 113 pace, which is roughly sort of Ironman race pace, a little bit faster. But again, you're in a pool rather than being out in the ocean. So I feel like you should be a little bit faster. And that's, again, I think the key with Ironman is, in the month before, is getting your body more and more used to being at race intensity. So yeah, that's a perfect session for me. However, another one that I do is I go to the sea here and I just swim for 1 hour continuous, because I'm always surprised by how hard it is on your arms to actually just swim for 1 hour continuous without that sort of like little 2 second rest at every tumble turn. I think it's always a big shock to me, is actually swimming for 1 hour continuous rather than having that little micro rest every 25 or 50 meters is a big sort of change. And yeah, it doesn't matter how fit you are in the pool. If your arms are hurting after 2-2.5 kilometers in the open water, then you're going to have problems. And then biking, again, it's similar to, as I said, everything now is about just being at race intensity. So I like to do a 5 hour bike ride where I usually do like an hour and a half warm up, and then I do 2x90 minutes at Ironman pace, which for me is usually between 270 to 280 watts, which I'm 72 kilograms. So it's just under 4 watts a kilo, which is an awesome numbers by if you compare me to a Sam Laidlaw or Magnus Ditlev. But yeah, it's what I have, and it's about getting used to your own training zones. And then for running, and that the running has changed a little bit over the years, whereas in the past I used to do really long runs of like 38, 39 kilometers, whereas now generally I don't go over 30 kilometers. And I do like 30 kilometers with 20 kilometers at race intensity. However, the one thing being is that 30K run is usually the day before. I've also done like a 22, 23 kilometer run in the hills. So the legs are tired and fatigued going into that 30K run. I just find I get more benefits by combining those two rather than doing like one standalone really long run where it just seems that I take a long time to recover from that sort of effort.
And do you do in the weeks leading up, do you have multiple runs that are in that maybe 25 to 30 kilometer range that you're building up to that 30 kilometer run, or do you even have multiple 30 kilometer runs over a few weeks to have several of them, or is it more that you can jump from low to mid 20s straight to 30 and then not do so many long runs at all?
I'd say usually I have like three similar runs. Usually they're all about 30K, but what changes is the duration that I'm running at race pace intensity. Usually I start the first week at like 14 kilometers and then progress to 16 and then jump up to 20. And a big part of that is also getting used to race nutrition. I always find the race nutrition is not easy, but it's a lot more tolerable than trying to sort of, for me, I try and get 60 to 70 grams of carbohydrates whilst I'm running. And that always takes a little bit of time to get used to for me. So that's one of the sort of reasons I do that, especially sort of the 20K at race intensity, is to have over an hour where I'm trying to consume that 60, 70 grams. So a part of that session isn't just to get used to race pace, but it's also to get used to race nutrition, which I think ruins a lot of people's races.
Mm. And this is Kona specific or related to Kona, but also potentially other races, heat prep and also altitude. For what races might you be doing that, and how do you do that? What does the protocol look like more or less for when you are going to altitude, when you're doing heat prep?
I've done both. I've done a lot of altitude, and obviously being in Girona, you're sort of forced into heat training every year. I think altitude, I've not used as much since I did Ironman training. I've went the last 2 years, but a big part of it is just to be up in the mountains, and it's a place that I enjoy training, and I think it's great to build strength because you're just cycling up and down mountains all the time. So yeah, obviously there's benefits to altitude training, especially with regards to sort of oxygen transportation. However, I don't really use it to focus on any racing now. With heat training, I obviously do it the entire summer here in Spain. We get up to like 36, 37 degrees during the day, and I don't try and avoid the heat. A lot of athletes here like to do things either really early in the morning or late at night. However, I go out in the afternoon because even if at times you have to cut back on the intensity, I think I just genuinely feel, not just for Kona, but just my actual fitness improves massively if I'm out in the heat. I just think it's a great stress to the body. And yeah, obviously with Kona, it helps a lot. But yeah, I think with regards to heat training, I'm all for it. And yeah, it just happens naturally here in Girona. But I'd love to go out in the midday and when it's 36, 37 degrees. And as I say, even if that means I have to sacrifice a little bit of intensity, because the one difference I make is that I always wear a heart rate monitor when it gets hot here. And I cut back the intensity when I see my heart rate's just going way above where it should be. And yeah, I think for me, that's been a key to how I've performed, not just in Kona, but also later on in the races during the year.
Yeah. Do you do anything specific? Because obviously Kona is a bit later, even though you might still get some pretty hot weather potentially, but Or you could, yeah, you could pretty easily within in the 2 weeks or 2 weeks before you leave. But do you, if you happen to have a cooler September, would you do anything indoors, any heat prep or?
The one big difference for Hawaii is, I think I mentioned it earlier, is that I'll go on the turbo trainer to do longer. So even sometimes when I said to buy 90 minutes at race intensity, I have did that on the trainer in the past. And that really sort of, yeah, it doesn't matter. I don't like to have air conditioning on when I'm on the trainer. I put on a, like a small little fan. And yeah, that's really, and I did similar before Singapore this year, is doing a lot of the biking indoors. And I think the turbo trainer is a great tool. And yeah, that's how sort of, if it's not super hot outside before Hawaii, I'll go indoors just to make sure that I don't lose that ability to perform in the heat, because sometimes in Girona we have hot Septembers, but sometimes it does drop off a cliff to temperature and it drops down to like the low 20s, which is nice, but it's not hot enough to prepare for Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And have you done lots of aerodynamic testing? Are you going to the wind tunnel or doing road aero testing or things like that?
In the past, I did more than I do now, I'd say. I actually, the first time I went was in 2016 with BMC. However, then after that, the next 5 years, my tri-suit sponsor, wetsuit sponsor, Hube Design, I think maybe you might have interviewed him as well, Dan Bigham.
Yep.
So, yeah, I worked with Dan. I started working with Dan in 2017. And obviously since then, he's went on to much bigger and better athletes. But I was the original guinea pig. And yeah, it was an incredible experience working with someone so incredibly clever. He's, when it comes to aerodynamics, he really does think of everything. He's, yeah, on a different level to a lot of other people. So, yeah, working with him in 2017 to 2021 until obviously now he's working with Ineos. I did a lot of testing in the velodrome with him. I also was in the wind tunnel with Swisside. And I've also been using in the past, you know, the Notio Connect device.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been using that and sending all the data to Dan, and Dan would analyze it. So, yeah, I've been fortunate that I've had access to it, especially in the early days, because back in 2016-17, it was mainly only bike companies that would support you to do such a thing, and it was generally just for a select few athletes. However, Hube with Dan, and it was a lot of it was coming from those guys just really pushing it, like, we really see it, something we can sort of really improve your performance. And obviously it works. In 2017, we found massive gains just before Hawaii, and we developed the Hube tri-suit massively over those years. And yeah, a lot of it is Dan's genius.
Yeah, no, that must have set you up well. So that's really cool. And yeah, now I guess we come into some more reflective questions about training and what you've learned and what you think, how you make decisions on a day-to-day basis. So one interesting question that I'm often thinking about is how to strike the right balance between working on strengths and weaknesses. And this can be both in terms of, like, you can have a strength or a weakness in swimming, biking, and running, but you also have some athletes that are more diesels and some that are more Ferraris and might basically have, yeah, different physiological strengths, which can be across the disciplines. So what are your thoughts on that? How does that work for you?
I think for me personally, I'm very much a diesel engine, and it doesn't matter, especially now that I'm getting a bit older and maybe the muscles don't recover as well. Whenever I try to train like a Ferrari, it never really works out too well. I obviously join the ITU guys every so often, a Tuesday night run session. But apart from that, I don't try and sort of change my physiology too much. I'm sort of a strength athlete that does well over the harder courses. And that's who I am. And that sort of, yeah, whenever I try and change it, it sort of ends in me sort of getting very tired and broken almost, to be honest. So yeah, I'm a diesel engine and that's sort of where I'm at. And yeah, I think that's, especially as I've got older, I tend to sort of be more cautious. I think when I try and do, yeah, as I said, when I try and do too much intensity, just the muscle pain afterwards, and I just never really seem to get the benefit from it now. However, with regards to sort of swim, biking, and running, what to focus on, I always look ahead to sort of what the race goals are in a couple of races' time and what the reward is for improving that sort of weakness a little bit. So if we take, for example, we were talking earlier about T100 or 70.3 World Championships. I love the T100 in that the biking is a lot more fairer. So it doesn't matter if you aren't right at the front coming out of the water, you have the ability to catch up on the bike or at least not lose as much time as you probably would if it was 12 meter gaps at the front. So that means that, you know, if I have a slight weakness on the swim, it's not as big a concern for me going into a T100 event with regards to, like, if I was doing 70.3 World Championships in 2 months, I'd probably sacrifice bike and run training in order to improve myself in the swim, just that 10, 15 seconds. And that I know that if I get out at the front in the 70.3 World Championships, it makes everything so much easier after that, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, absolutely it does.
I think that's probably something that's different between professional and age groups, is that professionals, they have to look at the race dynamics. And the reality is that, yeah, if there's 60 guys in the start line or 60 women and there's a 12 meter gap between athletes, you very much have to be at the front of the race from the start. So that's when you sacrifice the biking and the running to improve the swimming.
Yeah. How do you know when you're like normally tired or even good tired? This is, yeah, you've had a good stimulus of training, you're going to recover and adapt to it. And how do you differentiate that from when you're too tired, knocking on the door of maybe some overreaching or non-functional overreaching? How do you differentiate those two? And at what point do you decide to pull the plug on a session? What are your thoughts on that?
For me, and I think it probably goes for a lot of triathletes, is that we're very motivated people. At times, I think we're too motivated to train hard. And I've found over the years when my motivation for doing hard sessions sort of goes away, that's a big indicator that something's not quite right. And maybe it's time to sort of ease back a little bit. And I don't like to say scrap sessions or just stop sessions. One of the big things that I learned from Joel is that when in doubt, adapt a session so that you feel like you got something from it and you walk away feeling positive. So for me, yeah, on a continual basis, I'll happily adapt sessions if I don't feel the motivation. And again, I know that's not a super scientific approach, but I think for me, when my motivation isn't there to do hard work, that's when I know there's something wrong. And rather than forcing myself through it, it's a lot better to take one or two sessions where you adapt a little bit and not keep on pushing and find yourself in that sort of overtraining mode, which, to be honest, I spent a big part of my youth being overtrained and too tired and, yeah, basically sort of borderline need a 2 week holiday.
And what do you think, what have you learned from that experience, or what led you to that? Was it just, yeah, not really knowing how tired you should be, or can you talk more about that, and then we can maybe draw some conclusions from it?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, especially with, I'm obviously a very motivated person. I think a lot of most triathletes are very, very motivated. But I think when I was younger, I saw if I couldn't do a training session exactly as planned, that was a failure. And I had to make up for it the next day, which would always end up with me getting more and more tired. And then I'd get to the point where I was just exhausted and maybe I'd have to take a day off. But then I'd just jump back into the same cycle of training too much, feeling disappointed when I started to get tired and couldn't hit the sessions as I wanted to. And then, yeah, take another day off and then just keep on repeating. And a big part of it was a lot of my early days, I didn't really have a coach. It wasn't until Joel started coaching me in 2013, 14, that I actually had a coach writing a plan for me. In the past, when I was training in Britain, there'd be like a swim coach that you'd go and do five swims a week with him. And there's a run coach who would give you two run sessions a week. But the day-to-day planning of everything else was just done by the athletes, which, you know, I was training with Alistair and Jonathan. It obviously worked for them brilliantly. But I think for a lot of us, it just ended up making us pretty broken, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that's a pretty good segue into the question about what are your three biggest training or general like performance-related mistakes that you've made in your career?
The biggest one is being massively, I wouldn't say massive, I'd say overtrained, but consistently overtrained for, I would say, a good 5 or 6 years, to be honest. I think in my ITU days, and I look back on it and it's so obvious, my best results would come maybe 2 weeks after I've been like so tired that I've just been forced to take a day or two off and then recovered and managed to get a good race. But then because I've got a good race, I've been even more motivated to go and train harder again and get more tired. And then the next three races end up in disasters. So yeah, it's very much been overtraining, pushing myself too much. And some of it comes down to just not having a coach to sort of tell me to back off. And yeah, I think that's sort of been the fundamental thing that sort of, yeah, to be honest, I think I still pay for it now. I think my body would be in a much better place now if I hadn't did so much training when I was younger. That's a bigger one. And I think just going into that theme was probably just starting to train with Joel in 2013, 14, and him really challenging me on, like, what are you doing? Like, because when I started training with Joel, I'd do his training with like Mario Mola, Richard Murray, but it just didn't seem enough to me. So I'd try and sneak off and do extra like runs and stuff and extra bike rides by myself. And he'd be like, David, no offense, but these guys, Mario, Richard, they're better athletes than you. Like, why are you trying to do exactly what they're doing, but then doing more? Like, it's just not working for you. At some point, you have to see this. But yeah, I think it took a long time for me to come to sort of, maybe I sort of knew it, but it almost came to a point where I was just an exercise addict, if that makes sense. I just had to get that sort of like always having to train. And I think some of it was from those years not having a coach. But to be honest, training with Alistair and Jonathan in 2011, 12, it was incredible the volume that we were doing on a weekly basis. And they could recover from it and they were the best in the world. But I just didn't have that recovery and I struggled with doing that volume and intensity. And yeah, I think, as I said, I think all these years later, I think my body still sort of struggles from those times.
Yeah, no, that's, thank you for sharing that. That's, I think it's super common, as you say, and also just the fact of, I can definitely also resonate with that, or sometimes feeling that, am I doing this actually to improve my performance or just because I'm addicted to exercise?
And yeah, yeah.
It's hard when, because as you say, so triathletes are so motivated and you can easily make yourself think that doing more will make you better. But yeah, it's not, it's being objective about that is really hard. So I guess that's where somebody like Joel really can help massively. But I think another point there on the on the massive volume and training with Alistair and Johnny and how the success they had is something that I've been thinking about, that a lot of things in training comes and goes a bit in cycles. And I think now we're in a bit of a high volume cycle where I think high volume is really glorified, and there are lots of great athletes that seem to be doing very high volume, but I think you always have to be really careful with that, because it's a bit of a survivorship bias there, that some athletes that end up becoming really good do it that way, but some other athletes that could maybe have become equally good or even better maybe didn't make it because of that. So I think that at the end of the day, to have to find what works for you and not really go so much with whatever the trend is. Not to say that that's a like necessarily a bad trend. We know that it does require a certain volume of training to become really good at endurance sports, but that was just something that came to mind on that note.
I think almost a trend in Britain back in that sort of period was just to train as much as possible, and it was literally like 40-hour training weeks. It was I'd be running 10 times a week, which it's crazy to think that sort of I was probably running 140 kilometers on a weekly basis for 6-7 months of the year.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. And then moving on to the next question, then you have already mentioned some of these, I think, but can you repeat and add, if there's anything to add, what are the things that you've found consistently working well for you in training?
I'd say, especially as I moved to Ironman, a lot of strength work just across everything. So a lot of paddle work on the swim, a lot of over gear work on the bike, and I think that was the thing that actually finally shifted my bike. I'm still not a great cyclist, let's be honest, but I think my biking has improved since doing a lot more strength work. I think that's worked way more than anything else I've done in training, was doing a lot of over gear work on the TT bike, but also just going and riding in the hills here, or going up to Fontenoy more altitude and riding up and down the mountains. I think strength on the bike is fundamental to our sport, and similar to running is that I love to run in the hills, and I think strength, I'd say, I always think when it comes to an Ironman, in the last 10-15 kilometers of the run, when everything hurts, I don't care about the pace anymore. It's just about moving one leg in front of the other, and that just requires a strength that I think can be found by running up and down mountains all day, to be honest. It's a big part of my running training going into an Ironman. I do a few key sessions where I'm looking at the pace, but I do the majority of my running just by going up and running into the hills here in Girona. I think, strength is such a key thing to our sport. So I think that sort of covers most boxes. But then also in the last couple of years, I've been in the gym a lot more than in the past, and I don't know whether that's as I've got older, I find a lot more benefits for me being in the gym. But I think that's sort of been really useful over the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. On the bike with the strength work, do you have an example of a session that you like using?
So we have like a famous climb here that all the cyclists go to do their efforts on. It's called San Martín Sacam, and it's about 7 kilometers long. So I will happily go and ride it. I go up to like 4 times. So it's usually like 4 by just over 20 something minutes, throughout 25 minutes, to be honest, at like 50 to 60 cadence. And usually it's like 320 to 330 watts. So above my Ironman race pace, it's more like 70.3 power. But it's very much down to 50 to 60 cadence. And that's the power I look at it, but the main important thing is to keep that cadence at 50 to 60 RPM. And it's a gradient of 78%. So it's steep, but not crazy steep. So that's one of the sessions that I like to do, is just, Then to contrast that, I also like just to get my gravel bike and go and climb up the mountains here in Girona and go up gradients of like 15-16% and really sort of get down to like 35-40 cadence. And yeah, it's not a structured session, it's just very much go and find some steep hills and ride up them. But I think I mentioned earlier that sometimes I really like to do things just because they're fun and it motivates me. And I think cycling in the mountains here for 3 or 4 hours going up really steep hills is a great session.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And what can you give 1 to 3 examples of the best piece of coaching advice that you've ever received?
I think I mentioned it with regards to sort of Joel sort of really challenging me on my need to always be doing more. I think that took a long time. I think if me and Joel sometimes laugh about it now, because this was over 10 years ago, but how I was nice to train, like be like as an athlete, it was nice for him to coach me, but I also came with my challenges. We never argued, but we always sort of, he always had to question what I was doing. I was very stubborn, but I was never in an aggressive way, if that makes sense. We always sort of, yeah, I was a difficult child, we'll say that. So yeah, I think that was sort of really sort of, yeah, fundamental for me still being in the sport, to be honest. I think if I'd continued down that path, I'd have been burnt out 5, 6, 7 years ago, and I'd be in a normal job by now. So I think that's the biggest one. Other ones, I think David Tilbury Davis is a great coach, and he very much sort of instilled in me in that it's okay to do things just because you want to do it and you enjoy doing it. Training doesn't have to be always sort of scientific and sort of, if he told me to do a session of, I don't know, 4x10-minute hill reps on the bike, but there was a really nice climb that took 12 minutes to go up and I wanted to get to the top, so instead of doing 4x10 minutes, I did 4x12 minutes. He wouldn't care. He'd be like, if that's what motivates you, then do it. And I think that was really useful, is that fundamentally you have to enjoy what you're doing, and if that's what motivates you, then do what motivates you. It's sort of, yeah, it's a very hard sport and you have to enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's perfect. Let's see. Yeah. Let's go to some quickfire numbers and other questions. So you may have this prepared. The first one is, what were your total training hours in 2023?
So Training Peaks tells me it was 1,248 hours, which is 24 hours per week.
All right. Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, was that including strength training as well, or just swim, bike, run?
I think that includes strength training, and included, I had 3 weeks of nothing, I think, after Ironman Italy.
Yeah. All right. And what is your typical sleep duration per day, including both nighttime sleep and naps?
All the age group athletes listening to this will hate me because I can say 9 hours, which I know is a very big luxury. But yeah, it's 9 hours, which has increased over the last couple of years. I never used to need 9 hour sleeps, but yeah, that's where I'm at now.
And what is your typical carbohydrate intake in grams per hour and fluid intake in liters per hour in races? And this might be vary, of course, but give some examples.
Yeah. So the bike, I always try and hit like 100 to 110 grams. Fluid, it just varies massively on the conditions. A race like Hawaii, I'm going through like almost 2 bottles, like 1.5 liters per hour. But most races, it's like 750 mils per hour. And then in the run, I try and do 60 to 70 grams of carbohydrates per hour. Yeah, and then, to be honest, the run, I have no idea how much fluid I take in. I just try and grab. It just depends on the quality of the aid stations, whether you get a bottle, you get like a little paper cup, basically.
Yep. When and what was your first ever triathlon? And do you remember how you placed or how you did there?
So my first one was New Year's Eve in Edinburgh in 2006. And we have a race where you swim in the pool because it's the 1st of January. So I think it's 400 meters swimming. The bike is roughly 20 kilometers and the run is roughly 5, but it's not exact. I can't remember my overall place, but I'm pretty sure I was the first junior, mainly because at that time in Scotland, I was probably the only junior, to be honest.
So how old were you at this point?
I was that 2016. How old was that? 2006, that was. So I was 16, 17? Oh, this is 18. 17, 17. That's it, 17. Yep. Final answer.
All right. And what would be your favorite destination race? You can also say some bucket list race here if you were to enjoy a bit of vacation after racing there.
Not sure. It was Hawaii, but I've already did the holiday after Hawaii, so I feel like I need to do something different. I'd love to get to Australia. I've not actually did any 70.3 or Ironman racing in Australia. I raced the ITU race in Sydney, but that was in 2012. So I think at some point before I retire, I'd love to get to Australia to do a bit of racing / holiday after.
Sounds good. And then the final question here is, can you pick your podium for the Olympic triathlon individual races, the men's and the women's?
Okay. I think I need to take away everyone that I train with because, yeah, I'll tell you who's the best of the rest.
Yeah.
We're taking away Vincent Louie, Yella Jens, Vasco Velasa for the men's side, and for the women, we have a couple, Melanie Santos for Portugal. But I think for the men, it's very tough. I think a lot of it depends on obviously who Britain take, I'd say. But I'd say Alex Yee, who's obviously guaranteed his place. And then I'll go for Leo Bergerer and then Christian, because I feel like Christian, yeah, he's like the king of triathlon, so he has to be at some place there.
Yeah.
And then the women, it's going to be between Beth Potter, Georgia Taylor-Brown and Flora Duffy, because it'll be a swim bike breakaway and it'll be between those three in the run.
So do you want to put an order to that?
I'll go Flora Duffy, Beth Potter, Georgia Taylor-Brown.
That would be impressive if we would have a second gold from Flora.
Yeah, but I think it's possible. I think Yokohama was having not raced for almost 2 years. To come back and to be that dominant on the swim bike was really impressive. And if she's injury-free for the next 10 weeks until the Olympics, I can't see her not being there, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's see how that goes. That will be exciting. Curliari tomorrow, so we will get a bit of a sign of who's in shape. But thank you so much, David, for this. Just finally, where can people follow you? And is there anything else you want to mention before we close off this interview?
Not really. You can find me on Instagram. I would say Twitter, but these days I'm not really much on Twitter. So yeah, it's just David Macme Try on Instagram. And yeah, I'm very erratic on when I post and not. I'm not very good with social media. I like to listen to podcasts. You should listen to more podcasts.
Excellent. Excellent advice. Thank you so much. And have a good rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and there is a bunch of links to related episodes there, and especially multiple interviews with the people that were mentioned throughout this interview, like Dan Bigham, Joel Filial, and David Tilbury Davis. So a bunch of links there to check out if you haven't listened to those episodes already, or you just want to listen to them again, which by all means I would encourage. I want to piggyback a bit on what David said when discussing the best coaching advice he ever received. Basically, as you heard, it's not really about what sessions you should be doing or specific intensities or anything like that. When usually for most people, I think at least, when we think back to the best coaching advice we've ever received, But in David's case, it was things like challenging the drive to always be doing more. That is certainly a very common one in endurance athletes. And another one was giving him the confidence and belief to have more freedom and less rigidity in training, and that training is no less efficient. And that could increase the motivation and enjoyment. And personally, I'm a firm believer that when motivation and enjoyment improves, then response to training improves, even if the training is the exact same. So a lot of coaching can often be about improving that or increasing that motivation, enjoyment, and the buy-in into the training, and thereby getting a better response for the same input. So anyway, bridging that to a little bit of promotion for our coaching services at Scientific Triathlon. When you work with a Scientific Triathlon coach, it is much more than just a training program. It is a relationship with lots of communication. And by the end of that relationship, if you at some point stop working with us, then you'll come out of it not just having had great fitness improvements and race results, but with learnings like these, the examples that David mentioned, that you can take with you and benefit from for the rest of your sporting life. And this is also a reason why it's always better to start with a coach sooner rather than later, because that knowledge, and more than just knowledge, wisdom, I would say, compounds through the rest of your career. So it is like that old Chinese proverb that the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, but the second best time is today. So if you're interested in working with a coach, you can read all about our coaching services on scientifictriathlon.com/coaching. And you can email me directly on michael@scientifictriathlon.com to inquire about availability and schedule a free discovery call. Also remember that if coaching is out of your budget, we have various other options, including customized training plans, ready-made training plans, and one-off coaching consultations that you can benefit from. So check out all of that on scientifictriathlon.com. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Zen8 risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.